If you're the kind of person who goes to the gym, you may have seen classes there for Zumba. It's not just a fitness craze, it's also an international business. You can buy Zumba CDs, a Zumba video game, and Zumba clothes. For a lot of students, it's their first taste of Latin music and dance steps. But Yowei Shaw reports that some Latin dancers are trying to make more of a distinction between their art and what happens in a Zumba class.
Lines of women in spandex flail around as the ground vibrates with the pulse of the music. There's body rolling, fist pumping, shimmying, and yes, even some full-on booty shaking. Damaris Diaz was lip-syncing the whole time. After class, she told me that she's Puerto Rican.
I love that all these different cultures are embracing the Latin culture now because of Zumba. You'll see people mouthing the words to a song, and afterwards, they'll come to me and they're like, Damaris, what does that mean? And I'll laugh and I'll say, but you were singing the song.
The story of Zumba begins with an accident that seems too good to be true. Back in the 90s in Colombia, Alberto Perez was teaching an aerobics class and he forgot his regular music. So he reached into his backpack and pulled out tapes of salsa and merengue. Fast forward to today, and Zumba has certified over 250,000 instructors. Each class uses salsa, cumbia, bachata, and other Latin and international rhythms. For some students, it's their introduction to Latin music. Marianne Martino Giosa straddles both the Zumba and Latin dance worlds.
Do they cross? Yes. Do we see clients that go from one class to the other? Absolutely.
Giosa is a semi-professional salsa dancer and teaches 19 Zumba classes a week in the Philadelphia area. She's got the six-pack to prove it. She says there are clear differences between the two. Like in Zumba, you start a salsa step on both the left and right foot. But in salsa,
it's a no-no to take that step on the right or break to the right in a salsa class. It's just not proper technique. With it being an exercise program in Zumba, obviously we have to exercise both legs.
But Giosa says there's still disagreement over whether Zumba is really Latin dance.
The salseros would tell you that Zumba is not Latin dancing. But anybody who takes Zumba does feel that is part of Latin dancing, because technically we are Latin dancing.
They are vaguely misinformed.
Jose Maldonado teaches Latin dance at La Luna, the same studio where Giosa leads Zumba classes.
One of my students said, I took Zumba, I think I know how to salsa dance. And I said, fine, strut your stuff, let's see what you have. They couldn't salsa.
Perhaps what happened in yoga might be happening with Zumba and Latin dance. Joan White has taught the classical style of Iyengar yoga for almost 40 years. For her, yoga is a spiritual practice. White says it's not just physical fitness.
I find it extremely sad. It's like here is this wonderful tradition that comes from India, and now it's being completely overrun by people who have no idea what yoga is.
Authentic or not, Zumba has been good business for Latin dance. At La Luna, Zumba brings in as many, if not more, students a month as the rest of the studio's dance classes.
Ready, go!
World-ranked salsa dancer Darlin Garcia hopes to cash in on Zumba's popularity as well. His studio, Art in Motion, recently began offering Zumba classes, even though he still makes fun of it.
You're taking a salsa step, and in the middle of it, you jump into like a jumping jack. I mean, when you're mixing the two, that's funny, you know?
Zumba may be losing some of its Latin-inspired flavor. The company has recently expanded to include more international rhythms, from West Coast swing and belly dance to Bhangra and Bollywood. For NPR News, I'm Yowei Shaw.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The film version of The Hunger Games comes out in a few weeks. It's based on the best-selling young adult novel of the same name, set in a dystopian post-apocalyptic world. The hype around the movie has pushed sales of The Hunger Games trilogy to new heights. And as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, publishers are eagerly churning out more novels with similar settings.
In the beginning, The Hunger Games was not considered a sure thing. Why would it be? It's the story of a world where teenagers are forced to fight each other to the death in a game that's broadcast and watched everywhere, like a reality TV show. David Levithan, editorial director at Scholastic, which publishes the books, says the company took a risk on The Hunger Games because they trusted the writer, Suzanne Collins. It wasn't until Collins turned in the first manuscript that Levithan understood what he had.
It came in on a Friday, and I and the other two editors working on it read it over the weekend, and then that Monday, we just looked at each other and said, wow.
Now there are more than 26 million copies of all the Hunger Games books in print in the U.S., and all three books consistently top the bestseller lists. The film version of the book stars Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss, the courageous young heroine who volunteers to take part in the games in order to save her little sister from that fate.
Our tributes, Peter Mullark and Katniss Everdeen.
They just want a good show. That's all they want.
There's 24 of us, Gail. Only one comes out.
Dystopian fiction has been around for a long time, but the success of The Hunger Games has spawned a whole new crop of books set in a grim future where an authoritarian regime is just begging to be overthrown. These books are aimed straight at a teenage audience.
Dystopia is the new vampire, for sure.
Sarah Petrie is not a teenager, but she loves young adult fiction and writes about it on her website, Forever Young Adult. Look in the young adult section of any bookstore and you'll see shelves full of these books. Some of them even have covers that clearly imitate The Hunger Games. Petrie says there's always a hero or heroine, no older than the early 20s, faced with a life-or-death situation in a post-apocalyptic world.
You know, it's fun to see so many books try to guess how the world will end. I mean, there's supervolcanoes been very popular, virus is very popular, nuclear bomb is very popular, but it is kind of fun to see writers trying to stretch and be like, what else could happen? What other terrible tragedy could occur?
It's kind of an alternate history of the United States in which love has actually been declared a contagious disease.
Lauren Oliver says she never intended to be part of a dystopian fiction trend. She just wanted to explore the idea of a society that views love as a disease and forces its citizens to be cured of it at the age of 18. Pandemonium, the second book in her trilogy, has just been released. Oliver says young people today can identify with the characters in these kinds of stories.
The young protagonists are inheriting this kind of dark and broken world, and with a little bit of pluck and courage have to navigate it and try to salvage some kind of happy ending. And I do think there's a lot of parallels to how young people kind of feel nowadays as they're confronting this future, which is very uncertain in this country economically, and they're inheriting what they see as kind of a broken world.
The best of these books, says Sarah Petrie, offer richly imagined visions of a world changed forever by a cataclysmic disaster. In Juliana Baggett's Pure, a massive bombing leaves survivors forever fused to whatever they were doing at the moment of the detonations. Petrie says it's a riveting device.
I loved how gross the mutations were in her book. She had a doll's head for her hand. She had the guy she likes has, like, birds in his bag. It was really fascinating and gross. It's like a train wreck. You can't look away.
Rebellion plays a big role in these books, says Petrie, and it helps to have what she calls swoon, that is, a hot romance. Most are action-packed. Some, like the Chaos Walking trilogy by Patrick Ness, are violent.
If you think Suzanne Collins is mean in Hunger Games with all the people she kills, just wait till you meet Patrick Ness. I mean, he will make you cry. I cried so much reading all three books, but I found them to be absolutely amazing.
Not everyone is as big a fan of these books as Petrie. David Levithan, understandably, has a warm place in his heart for The Hunger Games, but he's not convinced that dystopian fiction will knock the vampire off its young adult perch.
I, as a reader, when I finish a dystopian novel, I just want to go read Pride and Prejudice. I feel that if you sat there and only read about broken worlds over and over again, I think it would get a little bleak and tiresome. So I'm not quite sure people are just reading this in the same way that they were like, oh, I'm just going to read vampire romance over and over again.
Of course, a dystopian world with vampires, that's another story. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This Saturday evening, HBO presents a made-for-TV movie called Game Change, based on the nonfiction book about the 2008 presidential race by John Heilerman and Mark Halperin. The telemovie focuses on Republican Senator John McCain's selection of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his running mate. HBO's Game Change has been attacked in advance by a Sarah Palin PAC that labels the film HBO fiction. It's also been attacked by Palin herself, who said recently on Fox News, "Hollywood lies are Hollywood lies." John McCain has said he won't watch the film. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
There are times when TV dramas about national politics and politicians deserve criticism, even ridicule, for their fast and loose narratives and characterizations. Recent miniseries about the Reagans and the Kennedys, loaded with unsubstantiated dialogue and action, are only two very fresh examples. But Game Change is entertaining and commendable precisely because it stays so close to the facts, not because it strays from them. The TV movie is directed by Jay Roach and adapted by Danny Strong. They're the pair that presented Recount, an earlier HBO movie about a stranger-than-fact presidential race, the 2000 George Bush-Al Gore Hanging Chad contest. In that 2008 movie, Laura Dern played Catherine Harris, the Florida Secretary of State who found herself suddenly in the limelight and at the center of a huge national political controversy. Dern played her beautifully, but also comically. And I can sympathize with those who have yet to see Game Change and are wary that Sarah Palin, played by Julianne Moore, may be treated as an equal object of ridicule. But she isn't. Palin is portrayed with empathy. And that focus, along with Moore's absorbingly effective performance, makes Game Change work. HBO's publicity team has leaped into the fray, defending the accuracy of the production and pointing out that screenwriter Danny Strong conducted 25 additional interviews as supplementary research for his screenplay. The book was criticized and questioned for not citing its sources. But it's easy, watching the movie, to guess the identity of the primary sources. In Game Change, the political aides who end up clashing with Palin the most, Woody Harrelson as Steve Schmidt and Sarah Paulson as Nicole Wallace, get the most screen time of any aides and are presented the most positively. Yet the story itself, of why and how Palin was plucked from thin air, or at least Alaska, to bolster the Republican presidential ticket, is strong enough and complicated enough that this HBO drama wisely plays by an old political broadcasting rule. Dramatically, at least, it gives both sides equal time. In the book version of Game Change, Sarah Palin didn't emerge until well past the halfway point. Advanced criticism from those who have yet to see the drama charge that HBO is telling only part of the book's story. That's perfectly true. But dramatically, in TV movie terms, it also makes perfect sense. HBO's Game Change is the story of a woman thrown suddenly into the national arena, playing a political game with enormous stakes, and trying to impress and improve in one media interview and televised debate after another, and not always succeeding. The Tina Fey impression of Sarah Palin, which is shown in Game Change, was all caricature and exaggeration, honing in on her ill-informed answers, her photogenic appeal, and her sentences to nowhere. Julianne Moore's Sarah Palin, though, is a character, not a caricature. When advisors push her too hard to study for a debate or an interview, she pushes back or shuts down. And the underlying tone of those scenes on both sides is frustration. In a car, heading to an interview with CBS News anchor Katie Couric, Sarah Palin, played by Moore, is in the back seat writing something, while advisor Nicole, played by Sarah Paulson, is in the front seat trying to prep her. But Nicole encounters resistance because the McCain campaign hasn't come through on some Alaskan poll figures requested by Palin.
Knowing Katie, I'm sure she's going to ask about your stance on feminism.
Did she get the numbers?
The what?
My approval rating in Alaska?
They're not in yet.
I am trying to trust you people, but you're making it really hard for me.
I'm sorry, Governor. I'll call Steve right away about it.
Not like that'll do anything.
What are you working on, Governor?
It's a questionnaire from the Matsu Valley Frontiersmen in Wasilla. You know, an Alaska paper.
Don't you think we should prepare for your national Couric interview first?
Nicole, I don't. This is my priority. I am not going to ignore the people of Alaska anymore.
That awkward, weighty silence is something you hear more and more as Game Change proceeds. In some scenes, as advisors try to prepare her for the next interview or debate, Moore's Sarah Palin has almost no lines at all. Instead, she just ignores the questions, taps out text messages on her cell phone, and goes into a passive-aggressive cone of silence until the other person gives up and retreats. Both sides have reasons for their frustration. But the whole point here is that there are two sides. They should be unified, working as one political machine. But in politics, as in life, personal agendas and personalities have a way of surfacing and even dominating. That happens in the HBO movie Game Change, just as it happened on the campaign trail in 2008. And just as it's happening now, in a political firestorm about the very existence of this telemovie, much less its content. But HBO's Game Change, to me, offers two things that make it praiseworthy. It's fair and balanced.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Anne Marie Baldonado, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
Political junkies have been anticipating this film for months and months. On Saturday, HBO debuts Game Change. That's the film about the failed presidential candidacy of Senator John McCain. Much of the anticipation is over the portrayal of McCain's running mate, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Here's TV critic Eric Deggans.
There were a lot of good stories from the 2008 presidential election, but the film Game Change focuses on John McCain's best asset and most unpredictable weakness.
Senator, I am honored to be chosen as your running mate.
That's not Sarah Palin 4 years ago. That's Game Change star Julianne Moore.
It turns out the women of America aren't finished yet, and we can shatter that glass ceiling once and for all.
It's a remarkable performance. Moore mimics Palin's distinct speaking pattern while avoiding a Tina Fey-style parody. As a political nerd, I love seeing Game Change's details on how candidates are coached for debates and interviews. In this session, Woody Harrelson as campaign manager Steve Schmidt discovers a problem while asking practice questions on the campaign bus.
How do you plan on maintaining our alliance with Great Britain on Iraq, even though support for the war there is at an all-time low?
I think the United States has always maintained a great relationship with the Queen, and John McCain will continue to have an open dialogue with her.
Governor, the Queen is not the head of government in England. She's the head of state.
Well, then, who is the head of government?
The Prime Minister.
A group of Palin's past and current aides have already denounced the film, which presents an emotionally fragile candidate unprepared for the job she's seeking. But the filmmakers say their script uses the book and their own interviews with more than 24 Republicans who worked on the campaign. That's where they found that anecdote about the Queen of England. And they often humanize Palin. Even when her emotional problems led McCain and Schmidt to have a doctor secretly observe her at a party, he came to a simple conclusion.
How's she look? For a woman who's just had a baby, has a pregnant teen daughter and a son in Iraq, I'd say not half bad.
Still, Palin fans won't enjoy the scenes where she fumbles facts or presses McCain aides to lie about her background. And you could ask why HBO is rehashing a four-year-old failure, just as the GOP is trying to retake the White House today. But what Game Change also shows is how celebrity can eclipse knowledge in today's 24/7 political news culture. Remember, we actually thought Donald Trump seemed a possible candidate for this year's primary. HBO's film explains how the search for star power led McCain and Schmidt to choose Palin in the first place.
We live in the age of YouTube and the 24-hour news cycle. How else do you think a man who has absolutely no major life accomplishments is beating an American hero? We need to create a dynamic moment in this campaign, or we're dead.
In the end, Palin's rise energized a deeply conservative wing of the Republican Party, which has kept this year's GOP primary in play. HBO's Game Change feels like a prequel for the election we're experiencing right now. And regardless of party affiliation, that's the kind of movie I wouldn't mind watching anytime.
Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times.